Martin Luther King was killed April 4th, 1968. They sent out a call, the elders, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, Alabama, Georgia, Florida. This is not a secret. We can talk about this now. We were told to come home. And we came home. They used to sing, "We Shall Study War No More." That wasn't the hymn they were singing. They told us, we have to defend these communities. They have killed our king. All hope is lost. So now we got the backing of the elders. So I did my thing. I did what I was told. I went throughout every ghetto, every swamp, every one horse town that they sent me to, teaching people how to defend themselves, what I had learned in the military. I ended up in Philadelphia, ended up in New York, Chicago. When I come out here to work with a young group called the Black Panther Party, they had no idea. Police were killing them at random. They were standing up and shooting back with half-loaded bullets that they had bought from the surplus store. So I took them, and we had classes on how to defend themselves. And for that, I was attacked. A lot of people say, well, you shouldn't say that, but that was my role. I had to build the Ministry of Defense, not only for the Black Panther Party. I had to participate in building it for the Republic of New Africa, for the Mau Mau, for the Texas Black Liberation Front, for the Alabama Black Liberation Front, and so many other groups in this country in the 60s. And though I wasn't behind a mic doing it, I didn't hide it, because under international law, we have a right to defend ourselves. And we knew international law back then real well. And we know it more so today. So in the process of teaching, you hear about the shootouts here in Los Angeles and New Orleans and Seattle. Sure, I went there and I told them, I take responsibility for those brothers and sisters doing that because they were following my orders in every corner of the land. Everything we did, I'll take responsibility for it. Don't give me no credit, but I'm the one who put them out there, who trained them to do that. Don't put them in jail. If you think that there's a law being violated, then attack me. Okay, they came at me. I went to trial. We were acquitted. The jury said, no, the police were wrong, because we were basing it on laws that they couldn't deal with. So what do? First, they come with the Tate LaBlanca murders. Y'all know Charles Manson. Well, Charlie wasn't the first arrested for that. I was. They took me down to Newton Street and tried to, you know, scare me and whatnot. And I don't know what they're talking about, you know, because they would do it so often. But someone had written "Off the Pig" in blood of the victims on the wall. So automatically all the Panthers did it. So they came and arrested me for the Tate LaBlanca murders. A few weeks later, they arrested Charlie and Knowles. Then they come with another murder. That didn't stick. Criminalization process. So here come the Olsen's murder. That didn't even stick. Johnny Cochran, if he's here, he's more eloquent than I am. He could tell you in more detail. Stuart Hanlon, who was with me all those years, that even at that trial, with the FBI putting an informant agent in the jail with me, an informant agent in Johnny Cochran's office, this is two, an informant agent on the jury, this is three, and an informant agent who said I did the murder on the stand, this is four. And I could continue with some lesser ones, but four paid agents to convict me of this, they almost still lost the case. So So they spent a lot of money doing these things, and they did it all throughout the country and targeting certain individuals who they wanted to kill. They shot at me. I got bullet holes all in me. That didn't work, Nick. So this worked for them. And after that comes the denigration, brother, the slander, the lies and the deceit that people usually go for, because you got high-powered machines, media, that tells you that this guy's the quintessence of evil, that he was out for the destruction of all white people, that he wanted to kill all the Indians, and people begin to believe it all. Well, okay, and it's another prison. They say when war begins, truth is the first casualty, and that's very true. So you have to take everything with a grain of salt that you hear about those days and about today. Rumors and gossip. Be very careful when you hear rumors and gossip about someone who is on your side of the fence and someone is talking about them. Be very careful about that, because that's a common way in which they operate among us and cause those divisions. We have to struggle to keep that unity. What we solidified in the 60s, you hear about the Rather Underground, but do you know that you still have members still in prison? You have Marilyn Buck. I can't talk enough about Marilyn. She's one of my heroes. You've heard of Assata Shakur, but you never heard of Marilyn Buck, who was charged 77 years to life in prison right now with breaking Assata Shakur out of prison. You don't hear about Marilyn Buck and Dr. Matula Shakur, who are convicted for breaking her out of prison. You hear of Angela Davis, but you never hear of Rushel McGee, who, it wouldn't be this case, you would have never heard of Angela Davis. So I'm not trying to take anything from anyone, but I'm just trying to let you know that it's always more to it than what you see. So you should struggle to see beneath the surface. And the point I'm trying to get across everywhere I go is that, because I talked to Bobby Seale and David Hilliard and a lot of the old Kathleen, and I said, Bobby, I heard you one night. I saw you and Tom Hayden. You were at the Democratic Convention, and you're talking about the reminiscing about 1968 when the reporter asked you some questions, and you were talking like the whole Black Panther Party was a part of the Democratic Party. Oh, Geronimo, man, you tell you to come out of the pen, man. You know, man. Look, Bobby, shut up. I told him, you shut up, man. Now, Bobby is my brother. That's why I can tell you what I told him. And I love Bobby. Bobby, Huey, and all of them, they were victimized like no other by these dogs. And if you could exist like they existed under such victimization, they spent millions of dollars victimizing those brothers in those various circumstances. That's why don't be too quick to criticize them until you understand the whole picture. But I could do it. And I told him, Bobby, don't let me hear you say that no more, man. Not after all these brothers and died. Oh, gee, I ain't gonna, It ain't that Bobby scared him. Bobby is my elder. But Bobby know we accepted constructive criticism. That's what it was all about. It's nobody above criticism. We weren't a part of no Democratic Party. We were this close for having the plebiscite, the referendums jumping off, where our nation can then finally speak once and for all and say what it wanted without all of these handkerchief-haired Negroes who's appointed by old Massa speaking for us. See, let them speak for themselves. That's what we were fighting for. If the plebiscite comes back and you opt and it's opting for a theocracy, then I'm sorry. That's what the mandate says. Even though I'm not for a theocracy, but that's what the majority of votes says. If it comes back for integration, which like I said before, I don't think it will, because integration has had 30 years of trial. And we've learned now that it's not going to work like that. But if it comes back like that, we're going to fight to protect that, because that's the voice of our people. If it comes back for nationhood, then that's what I really believe it will come back as. From what I understand, from knowing my nation, then all those Crips, all those Bloods, all those vice lords in Chicago, I've been traveling. They come at me and say, gee, man, you are. Well, all of them can be legitimatized. They will have a job. We got a nation to build now. If they get at you, people tell me, oh, you talking about this, you talking about a separate nation. Where it's going to be at? You hear about the 13 states? Look, don't go for that. That's a common tactic in opposing. Every nation in the world struggling to determine its own destiny. Here we, a big old nation is us. Big old rich, powerful, smart, intelligent nation is us. And they saying, no, don't go for that, because we tell them, wherever the nation is going to be, it's going to be decided on that plebiscite. I can't answer it. You can't answer it. Only the people collectively can answer that. We put it on the plebiscite. You understand? Because a lot of people get confused and they say, oh, yeah, because I can't see us all going to Georgia, Louisiana, the 13th state, theory and all that. All those were good ideological concepts in understanding struggle back during the day. But they were by no means the final solution. The solution is arrived at by the people's vote. Not what I say, but what the people say. That's the epitome of democracy. And if we deny that, then they are being anti-democratic. And we have a right to fight against that. Now, we further advocate these concepts and these ideas because we know this is the only way we can safely arrive at the answer to reparations. Because the way it is now, no one are going to unleash any reparations to us because we're too divided as a nation. Who are they going to let it go to? Like I said before, if they let it go to old Jesse Jackson, then Minister Farrakhan may be hurt. If they let it go to the SCLC, then NAACP may be hurt. So what we going to do, and what we've been advocating for years, is put that on the ballot. We're going to vote into reality our national treasury. And if it's a mandate vote where the majority of the people say, well, we want Ashaki to be our treasurer, then she's going to be our treasurer. The money is going to flow through what she organized and is going to serve like it's supposed to, 400 years of free labor. It's going to serve to build this nation. The only way we can arrive at it is that way, through the plebiscite. A lot of other suggestions, and the main one is, let's get the gun and take it. Comes real commonly everywhere I go. And I remind them, back in the 60s, we were highly trained. We could have taken over the White House. We could have shot every president they had. We never shot at a president. We could have gone in the Capitol here and done all that. But because our elders told us no, we had to listen. We didn't want to. I'm going to tell you right now, we didn't want to. But we had to listen to the wisdom of the elders. And the wisdom of the elders tells us today that you do not go get a gun and do it like that. You have to go this route. Because this route, everybody in the nation has a right to express what he or she so desires. For the first time since our ancestors were so-called emancipated after slavery. And that's a point I want to touch on briefly, because we hear a lot about Frederick Douglass, and Frederick is very important to our history. But Frederick advised the nation wrong and wrongfully when he advised them to opt for assimilation. When you had the majority of the newly freed slaves already organizing their own self-independent, self-reliant, autonomous situations. He was confused. And he was confused. He was getting old. We studied this very close. Okay? And so we're trying to straighten this out now. And we have to straighten it out. And this is why, because of an example I gave you, Frederick Douglass, another one is Nat Turner. I like to try to straighten out. Nat Turner should never be heralded as one of our heroes. A lot of people don't know that. Nat Turner was a zonked out preacher who had gotten up on a very elaborate scheme to overthrow that part of the slavocracy around the Dismal Swamps. He went outside and said he saw something in the sky, went and started killing a bunch of people and some babies. And he caused the brothers and the sisters who organized that great conspiracy to be exposed. Now, why do we extol Nat Turner? Because we don't go deep enough in our history. You don't know about Icewater Jack, a Mango, the Maroon, half black, half native. I think he was Cherokee, like Crispus Attucks. You know, Maroons, half black, half native, who all throughout history, militant resistance. You don't hear about that because we let somebody else write our history. You see, we got to write our own history. We have to bring forth the truth of these things that we use to base our historical struggle on. Why I fight so hard for people and to make them understand why my name is not Pratt. My name is Dijaga. Because of I understand the importance of a historical personality. People who have their history intact, they don't seem to understand this that much. But people who have these bifurcated, that tunis, that schizophrenic situation, not knowing, oh, I'm a Washington, or I'm a Brown, or no, I'm a Nkrumah, or man, what the hell? I don't know what the... You know what I'm saying? You're culturally confused. Next thing you know, you're going to rob something, your own dope. You have identity crisis. But once you regain your historical personality, you notice you don't find this among people like that because they got that oneness. So we struggle to tell people about this, that we have to regain our own historical personality. We believe that names carry spirit, the nomo. That's why they took it. Said, no, you're not Kunta Kinte, you're Toby. You see? And we have to understand that so we can regain our historical personality, so we can move forward into the 21st century as a free and independent nation, governed by ourselves. We have a comity with these people. We don't want to overthrow it. We never sought to overthrow the United States government. They charged me with seditious conspiracy when they busted me in Dallas. They charged Eldridge, they charged David and so many others. And then we're not trying to overthrow the United States government. All we're trying to do is build our own. And we want to be left alone in doing that. You see, when you come into our communities and you put the drugs in there, then arrest our brothers and sisters for selling the drugs you put in there, then put them in prison for selling the drugs you put in there, and you expect me to say, oh, you my leader? I mean, that's absurd. This is almost the year 2000, and it's absurd. It's a shame. You know, I don't know if you studied, but it's called colonialism at first, now neocolonialism. You got black males, you got black this, you got black that, but Malcolm said, like he said, the plantation is still being run the same. Why? Because you're part of that system that's by its very nature is designed to exploit and to kill you off. And if you don't know that by now, then that means you don't care. You have been tainted by that discipline I told you Che taught us about. See, the other discipline is conscious discipline, where you're in your heart. And you could tell a person, I don't want no $1 million. I don't want no bunch of women. I don't want no long cars or Cadillacs or fine clothes. I want freedom. That's what you want. I want freedom. I don't want my name on no TV. I don't want my name in a book. I don't want all that. I want freedom for this nation, so we can take our place among the nations of the world to lead not only Africa out of what it's going through, but the rest of the world out of what it's going through. We can be at the forefront, at the vanguard, because we survived slavery. That's a big thing. We are very audacious. We are very resilient. We can govern ourselves. Keep that in your mind. Think in that national context. We can govern ourselves, and we can be examples. You think once we, if that vote comes back for national independence, that there are going to be any more drugs in the community? Huh? Were there any drugs in the community in the 60s? You better ask somebody about Bed-Stuy, New York, Watts, Fillmore, Southside. You better ask somebody. We didn't have that. You're not going to put that on our little beautiful children. You're not going to kill our kids off. You see, we can police ourselves. We can govern ourselves. Keep that in the forefront of your mind, not at the detriment of anyone else. And what really propels that is keep also in the forefront of your mind. Because I was talking to Brother John Conyers with the Incobra, the group that set out to get the reparations, and they all keep running into these brick walls. And they're going to continue until we come together and get that national treasury together on the vote. So let's talk about that plebiscite. And let's refer back to the voter registration drives of the early 60s and the late 50s, when Brown versus Board of Education said, okay, we can vote now. You know, so we went and we had to learn so we can have an educated ballot. But this time we do it on an international scale for the plebiscite, like Quebec just recently did. Puerto Rico been trying to do for years and advancing. Hawaii is doing it. And you talk about the nation, if you don't want it in one place, in the South, vote for a nation in place. The Palestinians, vote for where we are at. Let's be declared a nation in place. Then we go for dual citizenship. That's what they don't want you to know. You go for dual citizenship next. And then all kind of doors going to open to you, from the International Monetary Fund to the local banking allowances that you will be qualified for. So these things we have to study, and we have to tell our people, quit being second fiddle. We don't need nobody to call us outside of ourselves to call ourselves our leader no more. And we got to get serious about it. We got to get serious about this plebiscite, and we got to get this first referendum done as soon as possible, because if we don't, all these young, wild, crazy, buck wild fools, I love them, throughout these communities, is going to go more crazier, and you're going to have more innocent people dead. You're going to have more beautiful young brothers and sisters dead in these prisons. And I'm talking about all communities, poor and oppressed communities. If we don't start moving on this, all I'm saying is let the people speak for themselves. And if you think I'm crazy, I want to see you after that first referendum comes back. And then we can stand proud. And we could then know what little Bobby Hutton died for, what Featherstone died for, what John died for, and so many others. Red, that's a whole nother story. We had some, I got to tell you, because I don't want to take too long, but We had a problem with male supremacist attitudes because we're in a decadent culture that puts these kind of things in your head, and we don't know no better. So we organizing in the 60s, and we oppressing these sisters that's in the movement. Well, we run into sisters like Red, who I just mentioned, who's not famous, but she's dead now. And you may, more of you have heard of Tupac's mother, Fanny Shakur, Kathleen Cleavers. We ran into some of the most beautiful sisters in the world that made us look at our male supremacist attitudes, our male chauvinistic ways toward them. And they transformed a whole generation of black male attitude to loving and understanding the importance of the woman. And I say that everywhere I go because this new culture seems to have a tendency to put the woman down, to disrespect the woman. I mean, it's crazy. And until you understand that, you have to not only respect that woman, but uphold her. Sometimes put on a pedestal that you're not going to get anywhere. Because in all my studies, I came to the conclusion that we would not have survived slavery if it wouldn't have been for the black woman. I really believe that. And I've been studying for years. And so it really hurts me down deep in my heart when I hear y'all call them sisters out their name. And I'm talking about Mexican sisters, Asian sisters, Native sisters, not just African sisters, because they're all beautiful and women of all walks of life, because we don't play that. Because we study in anthropology and we know where the truth comes from. So we know we are all related. You know, very good students of anthropology, by the way. And I just want to say that that's what we were about, and that's what I spent those years in prison for, not only to expose the truth of this murder, which was criminalizing not only myself and my family, but criminalizing my movement, our movement, and it continues today. And there are so many that are still left in there that I wish they were here, because they're much better speakers than I am, and they will have water in your eyes. Not that they want to have water in your eyes, but just to hear their stirs. You're talking about me being on hold for 8 years. Sure, I got shot during those years, and shot twice, and they set up and poison and name it up. But you hear some of the stories of Rochelle McGee, what he went through, of Hugo Pinnell, and why they went through it. That's what's going to blow your mind. For helping your daughter, or your son, your nephew, who the pigs were about to kill and set up and play their little games with. Defending them. Rochelle McGee didn't know little Jonathan was coming in there that day. Bill Christmas didn't know that. McClain didn't know that. That's the truth. Let the truth be told. But did they abandon him? Did they say, oh, this brother, you crazy, you in the courtroom with all these guns? Man, I'm gone. They couldn't do that. They wasn't raised that way. They were elders. They saw that little brother. He was, oh, man. And so they had to do something. They had to do something with him. And they lost their life. Rochelle McGee, the only one survived. And you call him a terrorist? This brother was helping people in the 60s in prison learn how to file suits. He the one taught me how to file a suit that got me out the hole. He said, Geronimo, what are you doing in the hole? I said, I don't know. He said, have you been on the main line? He said, you're not supposed to be in the hole. You come from the streets to the hole. He said, well, in prison, you're supposed to go to main line, a general population. If you mess up, you're put in the hole. He said, I said, okay, let me out the hole. I just wanted to fight. I wanted to get somewhere where I could expose the truth about this murder. And I hate to sound so selfish, but it was incumbent upon me to do this. Because you don't do that You don't say nobody done killed nobody. And you know he didn't kill nobody. And then you continue to say it and you put lie up on top of lie. And then the next thing with the Patricia Hearst thing. Oh, I organized the SLA and told them to go kidnap the folk. I don't have no communication. They wouldn't even let my sister Virginia right here in the front row in to see me. You know, it was in back in 73, 74. I didn't know nothing about no SLA. I ain't got no TV and no radio. You ain't letting me have no mail. You're trying to kill me every day. And Charlie Manson was the one who told me, said, brother, they're trying to kill you. When you go in that yard the next day, they're going to shoot you. Because Charlie was in the front row. We were in Folsom. Folsom in the hole in Folsom. And I said, what you talking about? He said, man, I was up all night, man. They plotting to kill you. They were just bragging. So I went to the yard anyway. They shot me in the head. You know. It was in 73. Then right after that, they sent me to death row for 18 months. I still don't know. I'm up there in incommunicado for 6 months. I don't know what's going on. People telling me, man, I think it's something out there. Some revolutionary group done kidnapped the president's daughter. We don't know what's going on. We incommunicado in those places. But now it's in books. Geronimo started the SLA. Yeah, I see it in books. You know, Sin Q was under his direct command. Death Row Jeff and, you know, y'all laughing, but that hurts. That hurts because you, number one, are not only being victimized by them, but you have to now be victimized by the people who put the SLA together. You see, who want the credibility. They want the credits. See, and they say, what Geronimo getting our credit? Well, I'm in the, what the hell going on? I don't know. I was confused, and it happened time and time again. The next thing was somebody put out a book, some opportunist named Joe Durden Smith from England. The title of the book was Who Killed George Jackson? It was 1977. Thanks. And, the cop came there back then to carry axe hounds. They didn't carry billy clubs. And he got to swinging it. You know, that's how they call themselves, whipping you and stuff. But, and later on, I would ask him, man, why do you people keep, you know, coming to the cell messing with me? So one of them told me, to cut a long story short, and I know it's a fact because it's in the book. It took me until I got out the hole to find this book. In that book is over 21 pages referring to me with a group of guerrillas in the hills, the Santa Cruz Mountains, training them to break George Jackson and Rushel McGee out of prison in 1971. I got busted in 1970. I wasn't even on the streets in 71. Yet I'm getting beaten by these stupid ass guards who done read a book by some opportunists who want to make some money, who done put my name in it to sell this book. So we can laugh, but that hurts. I've seen people lose their lives by that. People doing that, lying, monopolizing, capitalizing off the struggle. And I could name incident after incident after incident, but I don't want to go too long on this because I wanted to really get across this point that every nation struggling to be free has a right to struggle, a duty to struggle. And if you don't do that, then old Pimpin' Sam, he gonna do it for you. And you can't complain. Because on the international law, on the Geneva Accords, study your international law. And under the latter Helsinki Accords of 77, what we call the Protocols of 77, study those. Under that, we not only have a right, but we have a duty to liberate. As big as this nation is, we have a duty. And we're not the only ones. We have a duty to do this. And we always supported the national liberation struggles of the Americano people, of the native people, of all people who are struggling to be free. And I encourage you to continue. This is a beautiful example, the Cross Cultural Center. It's a very beautiful example of what we must do to come together as one to fight against that kind of thing that we've been dealing with all our lives. If we don't come together, we're not going to win. I'm telling you right now. We have to come together. Before you can have internationalism, you have to first have nationalism. We have to first organize out. Then we can interact as a nation with national dignity. When they used to call me Elmer Pratt, I used to get disrespected all the time. But I don't get disrespected no more, because people go, oh, that man know who he is. It's the same way with a nation. You keep calling yourself Americans, and you don't even know who Amerigo Vespucci was. If you did, you would never call yourself an American again. Amerigo Vespucci was one of the most despicable characters I've ever studied in history. He used to run dope from Portugal to Spain on the Iberian Peninsula. And it's right there in the archives in Spain, right there in Barcelona. We studied this extensively. He used to run laudanum. That's what they called it back then, from the poppy seed. And it was rumored that they used to take it themselves. That's why they didn't care if they sailed and the earth was flat and they'd fall off, because they were full of that dope. So what I'm telling y'all, every time you call yourself an American, you're giving tribute to an Italian drug smuggler. And I don't have nothing against the Italians, but I just want you to know that. So just go join the La Costa Nostra or something. Because we are not that. We are Africans. We are Indians. We are Native. We are Apache. We are whatever we are, whatever we say we are, because we have to define our own reality. We are no longer Toby. We are what we say we are. And you're going to respect it. In the 60s, you wanted to call us colored and Negroes. We came together. We said, we're tired of that. We're going to define ourselves. We are black. The first person said, oh, no. We colored. We Negro. And now everybody's black. Then we went through this process, which is ongoing, and we learned. We studied all the nations. We said, well, not one nation in the world refers to themselves with an adjective. Black is an adjective, but you know, we're dealing with the English grammar. So we had to restudy and we go back. But we realized that what we were doing was subconsciously what we were criticizing people all our lives. We were avoiding the fact that we are Africans. And we have to face the fact and be proud of the fact that we were Africans. And that's what we are. And to distinguish ourselves from our mother country, we call ourselves New Africans now. Now you hear a lot of people say, oh, no, no, just like they did with the Black Power Movement, what they call it, when we were trying to bring in the term black. You, in a few years, you're going to hear everybody calling themselves New Africans. They have to. We have to qualify for that plebiscite. We have to get that plebiscite off the ground. And you watch how quick we're going to be at the forefront of the world and leading the nations of the world down the path of what we're all about. And that's love. That's all it is. Che used to say, we can only hate our enemies with revolutionary love. Che was one of my heroes too. And Nkrumah, I mean, there were some beautiful brothers and sisters that we should study. And I notice there's not enough studying going on. And I encourage that. And so before I close, and I'm told I'm supposed to take some questions.